Hello, this is Jonathan Marks via PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another programme from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
This is Radio Netherlands, the Dutch International Service. Media Network, a weekly review of what's happening in the international communications business, hosted by Diana Janssen and Jonathan Marks.
Hello and a warm welcome to our weekly dip into the world of broadcast media.
Yes, we're weekly dipping again. Coming up this week, a special test from Norway and some special events in the Pacific. So grab a paper and pen or start a tape recorder. But let's begin with a follow-up to last week's show.
Torre Molinos, Torre Molinos.
Yes, we had a lot of useful feedback to last week's programme on location in southern Spain. And in fact, there's more to come. We were originally planning to play some more in this edition, but we've collected some other material which just can't wait. But to give you a taste of the response, here's a quote from Andreas Erbe, who writes from the eastern part of Germany.
I listened to your show last Thursday about developments in the digital radio and TV world. It was quite interesting to have people from so many countries reporting about the situation. However, there was one person from Germany saying that public broadcasters are experimenting a bit with DAB here, which is highly controversial in general. I agree, DAB really is highly controversial amongst decision makers, but it also seems that public broadcasters are not making big efforts to ensure it becomes popular. Here in Saxony-Anhalt, DAB went into regular service on the 1st of April after a test phase. It was the first region in Germany to put DAB into regular service. However, only weeks after this happened, the public broadcaster Mitteldeutscher Rundfunk switched off its programming on the DAB service, saying that the programmes may be restored at some future date. So today, only private broadcasters operate in DAB. In Saxony, the situation is even worse. At the end of 1998, the DAB test project ended, and regular service was to have started later this year. So all DAB transmitters were switched off. Meanwhile, it's said that in Dresden, one is back on the air. The other project ongoing here at the moment is a test of digital video broadcasting. That's terrestrial, but then used to carry audio services. There's much more frequency space available for DVB-T than DAB. It can reach stationary portable receivers, although there's not the same kind of reliable reception in a mobile environment.
Thanks, Andreas. And contrast that with developments in northern Norway, where apparently investments have been made below 1 megahertz.
This is Radio Norway International.
Radio Norway International is no more, at least not in the English language, on shortwave. But tomorrow night, Friday the 21st, there will be a brief respite, this time on medium wave. Ben Erfurt is a medium wave enthusiast, a regular listener to Media Network. He works for Norwegian Public Radio, NRK, and he's on the line now from the southern part of that country. Ben, you've helped organise a special test in northern Norway. Please explain.
What's going to happen is that a new AM transmitter is going on the air with a special program. The new transmitter for NRK Radio, which is located on a tiny island in Lofoten called Røst, out on in the Atlantic Ocean, actually, west of Bodø, which was the old location of transmissions.
And what frequency does this transmitter operate on?
It's on 675 kilohertz, the same frequency has been used for Norwegian radio from Bodø for many, many years, and the same frequency will now be used from Røst.
But what's happening tomorrow night? Because I mean, this is just a switch over from one transmitter site to another.
We thought it was a good idea to make some special arrangements to mark this event, and there will be a four-hour special broadcast coming exclusively from this new transmitter. It will not be in parallel with any other frequencies.
Now, what's the power going to be used?
I think the transmitter will run at its maximum, which is 20 kilowatts. That's a little bit more than it will be using when it's entering normal operation. It will then have something like 10 kilowatts.
Okay, and what time will it start?
It will start at 20 hours UTC and we will continue until midnight UTC.
But isn't this a rather unfortunate time of the year for this to happen, bearing in mind that you're almost heading towards the sort of midnight sun up there?
That's correct, and we had intended to put a transmission on air for last week, and every day now the night is getting shorter and shorter. But I think we will just manage to have some kind of grey zone in the area at the moment the transmission will be aired.
Of course, you have a little bit of competition from a radio station operating here in the Netherlands, a commercial station on 675, Radio 10 Gold, which uses a bit higher power, I think, too.
Yes, I think so too. But I think from major parts of Scandinavia, perhaps northern part of the United Kingdom, it should be possible, at least with some directional antennas, to have a taste of what's going on from Rust.
But I don't speak Norwegian. Is that a problem?
No. The program will be presented in English and Norwegian by staff from Radio Norway International.
But Radio Norway has actually stopped its English language programs on shortwave, so I suppose this is quite a unique chance.
It is a unique chance at least to get this special transmitter verified, but at the moment there is no definite plans to reintroduce any English broadcasts from Radio Norway.
Okay, let's just repeat the details then. It's coming from Røst in northern Norway on 675 kilohertz between 20 and 24 hours UTC. And if people hear the broadcast, what's the address they need to write to?
They should write to Radio Norway International, N/0340, Oslo, Norway.
But Bernd, having listened to those plans for tomorrow night, why is Norwegian Public Radio buying a new 20-kilowatt transmitter? And I understand planning a long-wave transmitter as well.
The main reason is to cover the area surrounding Norway, up in the north, the fishing fleet and so on, with a good AM signal. That hasn't been for the past years. Another reason is that we are seeing an opportunity to re-establish AM as a medium also for domestic use, introducing digital AM probably within a few years' time. The next stage in re-equipping the AM transmitters in Norway include plans for probably 150-kilowatt long-wave transmitter located at the very top of Norway, giving a really good signal into the Barents Sea area. The transmitter up there will be using an antenna that's 350 meters high, so it's extremely high construction.
Ben, thanks for joining us.
Coming soon from Radio Netherlands, Media Network continues the brand new series on African broadcasting. We visit a radio project in Burundi to review the success of community radio in the Great Lakes region of Eastern Africa. And we dig into the Richard Jinbe collection of African radio recordings.
A missionary station, Radio Kodak, opened in Bujumbura in 1964, broadcasting educational and religious programs in Kirundi, Swahili, French, and English.
Just some of the features still to come on Media Network. And of course, there'll be full feature support on the World Wide Web.
Yes, more great radio to come on your weekly communications magazine. Let's bring up the line now to Victor Gunatilaka in Colombo, Sri Lanka, for some tuning tips. Victor, you want to follow up specifically on the programme we carried on April 29th about broadcasting in war-torn Angola.
Yes, Jonathan, it really brought back great memories of DXing past, listening to Angola, and talking about stations in Africa in the 70s and 80s. And right now in Angola, that's Radio Nacional Luanda, provides a fairly good signal around 2300 UTC on two frequencies, 11955, that's 11955 and 4950 kilohertz. Unfortunately, no English broadcast, and you also need a little bit something better than just a portable radio for it.
Okay, although we're not really planning a sort of ABC, the next country we're planning to profile is Burundi. You've got memories there going back quite a long time.
Oh, yes. and real DXing memories, especially Radio Kodak, the Christian missionary broadcasting station on 4920 kHz in the late 70s and 80s. They were using just 2.5 kilowatts and provided a fairly good signal even on our domestic radio sets. And the QSL card is always, very special with such low power.
But if you're trying to hear a station out of that part of the world now, what would you go for?
The only chance is 6140 kilohertz. That's 6140 kilohertz for Radio Bujumbura, the national broadcaster from Burundi. They have an English news broadcast at 1645 UTC. That's on 6140 kilohertz. Unfortunately, it's not a very regular station on shortwave, but we heard it a couple of months ago. So you can still try it between 1615 and 1700 when the frequency 6140 is not being used by the BBC to beam to South Asia.
I understand, too, in neighbouring Rwanda, there's a pretty good signal, too, also on the 49-metre band.
Well, that's one of the most regular and easy listening stations from Africa. I mean, the local broadcaster. So Radio Rwanda, daily heard in South Asia on 6055 kilohertz with an English news broadcast as a bonus, and that's anytime between 16 and 1610 when they have four different language news broadcast, and English is one of them. So between 16 and 1610, look for that English news broadcast. They also have news in Kenya, Rwanda, French and Swahili. The frequency again, 6055.
Okay, time for one more tip.
Well, talking of jamming, Radio Free Asia's Tibetan language broadcast started to get jammed by the People's Republic of China on the 20th of April. The Tibetan transmissions between 13 and 1400 on 7470 and 11590 kHz, and again between 15 and 1600 UTC on 7470, 11510 and 13835 kHz are jammed using the domestic service of the Chinese National Radio.
Victor Gunatilaka on the line from Sri Lanka. And apparently, despite the recent incident between China and the NATO forces because of the accidental bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, there was no change in the jamming of Western broadcasters.
Now to Brian Clark in Auckland, who has a special piece of tuning advice again for tomorrow.
Well, Jonathan, tomorrow we celebrate a very significant anniversary down here in the South Pacific. It's the 75th anniversary of the first two-way radio contact between New Zealand and South America. And on the 21st of May in 1924, two pioneer radio amateurs, Z2AC, Ivan O'Meara in Gisborne in New Zealand, and CRCB8, Carlos Braggio in Argentina, established a world distance record with a two-way Morse code conversation over a distance of 10,300 kilometres.
So how's it going to be celebrated?
Here in New Zealand, Jonathan, we have a special DX award from the New Zealand Radio DX League, and this is for reception of Argentine radio broadcasts. And there'll be details of that award published in the local DX bulletins later this month, but they'll also be posted on the New Zealand Radio DX League's new website address, which is an easy one to remember, www.radiodx.com.
OK, that's what's happening in New Zealand. What about on the other side of the link?
Well, the Radio Club Argentino in Buenos Aires are very active in commemorating this anniversary. They're going to put on a special anniversary station. There are special call sign allocations, and they're also running competitions this week. They've actually got the very radio receiver that Senor Braggio used 75 years ago, and they are attempting to restore that to working condition for the occasion. And on the 21st of May 1999, they're going to operate a special amateur station, L75CB, CW mode on 80 metres for 24 hours continuously through the 21st of May, Buenos Aires time. Through till next Sunday, there'll be a lot of radio amateur activity involving Argentina. The Argentine amateur radio operators are permitted to use special call signs this week with prefixes L2, L3 and L4, and the special station L75CB will be operating through until Sunday and offering a special QSL card for contacts.
If people are interested in more information, how can they find out about it?
Well, they're also posted on the internet, Jonathan, at the Radio Club Argentino website, and the address for that is www.lu4aa.org. So that's www.lu4aa.org.
Radio Netherlands Consumer Investigation. We dig deeper.
In several European newspapers in the last couple of days, the respective national organizations representing musicians' rights have sounded alarm bells about the significant drop in the sales of compact discs. In Holland, for instance, sales in 1998 were down by 10%, although profits for musicians rose by 6% because more commercial radio stations are on the air.
The rights organisations all have the same story. The arrival of CD recordables and also CD-ROMs is encouraging more and more people to copy illegally at home, either on hi-fi apparatus or on their computer. So they want an extra tax on blank CDs in the same way that some countries have a tax on blank cassettes.
Bob Tomalski joins us on the line from London because he too is disappointed in CD recordables, but for another reason. He's referring to a dual CD recordable deck from Philips, which we mentioned in February.
Indeed, this machine is never short of controversy, is it? The CDR765 is a twin-deck recorder where it will, in theory, make a perfect copy of an original CD. But recently, we've discovered that it has a serious bug, a fault which Philips are not admitting. Let me explain. When you make a copy of a CD with this machine in the double-speed mode, it adds, if you like, an additional gap between every track. Now, normally with most pop CDs, this wouldn't matter. A gap between tracks is standard. But if you're copying classical music CDs, or indeed music where there is an ident but no gap, the copy always turns out with, if you like, a two-second silence between every track. Now, if the original disc didn't have that, and the copy does have this sort of silence inserted, Philips can no longer claim that you're making a perfect copy of the original. Now, where I've been having a bit of argument with Philips over this is that I claim that this is a fault, something which is a bug and shouldn't be there. Philips say, well, no, that's standard for the machine. And yet, the same machine virtually is available for computer use. And about a year ago, they launched a CDR drive, which is effectively the same mechanism for a PC, which had this problem on it. And Philips admitted the problem for the PC version and offered an upgrade via software via the internet. But now the consumer version for music is available. They're doing nothing about it and not helping consumers in terms of upgrading the machine or fixing the problem.
But is it really a problem in the sense that, you know, you're copying the music? So what if you get a CD with a few more extra tracks in it?
Not everybody wants to record music. Many people might like to archive radio programs onto a disc, as indeed I do. And when you're archiving a radio program, you might want to put an indent marker onto the disc to actually separate or to identify different parts of the radio program. And then later on, make a copy of that disc to give to a friend or whatever, and then find that the copy has got these two-second gaps between every little piece. So it would mean, for example, an interview, such as we're doing now, would be separated by a gap like that, which is very, very annoying. The big frustration about this is that a huge multinational company such as Philips is not admitting that there's a problem. In my view, as an independent journalist, that's downright unacceptable.
How much money have people spent on these machines?
The machine sells in the UK at the moment for £370. So my advice to people is if you're thinking about buying this machine, hold off. And the reason is that I've been told by sources within Philips that a replacement machine is due for the autumn, model CDR 775, where the bug will be cured, The machine will also work with what's called CD text CDs, and the machine could very well sell for less.
Last but not least, Bob, what about waiting for DVD recordables?
Well, if a company can't get their CDR working, how can they get DVD recordable working? OK, let's look at what they're doing. At the Berlin IFA show, which is coming up in September, Philips say that they will be showing a DVD recorder. Sounds great. But can the company give any technical information? Can they say whether such discs will play back on existing DVD machines? Will the machine have any bugs in it? Who knows? They're not giving any technical journalists, such as myself, any information about DVD recording whatever. They're just going to unveil it at IFA, and what are they going to say about it? Well, time will tell.
Bob Tomalski. And he'll be back in a later edition for news about the digital satellite decoder war, which has just broken out in the United Kingdom, and could impact on the rest of Europe. Now, where are we?
Just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour. That's orbiting at 19 miles a second, so it's reckoned a sun that is the source of all our power. The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at a million miles a day. In an outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour of the galaxy we call the Milky Way. Our galaxy itself contains 100 billion stars. It's 100,000 light years side to side. Bulges in the middle, 16,000 light years thick, but out by us it's just 3,000 light years wide. We're 30,000 light years from galactic central point. We go round every 200 million years. And our galaxy is only one of millions of billions in this amazing and expanding universe.
Well, I hope you're taking notes, because a lot of money has been invested over the last couple of decades in the search for intelligent life on other planets. The SETI project, which stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, was given a big publicity boost recently by the film Contact. In the real world, though, and more specifically at the University of California at Berkeley, scientists have just asked home computer users anywhere in the world to help them in their scanning of the skies. Dan Wertheimer is the chief scientist for the SETI at Home project, and before we came on the air, he explained why they had started giving away a very special screensaver.
SETI is limited by computing power, and the more computing power we have, the better job we can do. Together, the hundreds of thousands of people participating in this project form the world's largest supercomputer and make our search much more sensitive than what we've done before.
When we look at some of these films, like Contact, for instance, people are using these sort of huge Cray computers. Surely these are more powerful than people with home computers.
The Cray supercomputer is more powerful than a single home computer, but combined, we've already got the world's largest supercomputer. It's much bigger than anything that we could buy or build. We've done 100 years of computing just in the last few days.
How does it work then? You've got the radio telescope. It downloads data that is heard from the galaxy, and then what?
Yeah, we use the world's largest radio telescope in Arecibo, Puerto Rico. It's 300 meters in diameter. It holds 10 billion bowls of cornflakes. The data is recorded there, and then it's parceled out into little pieces, and everyone who's running the screensaver program can get a little piece of the data, a little part of the sky. When it's finished analyzing the data after a few days, it asks for permission to connect back over the Internet, send us the results, and get a new piece of data to analyze.
So you're responsible for chopping it up, as it were, and putting it into bite-sized pieces?
That's right. We're breaking up the data. We've got about 50 terabytes of data recorded at the world's largest telescope, but we break it up into these 300 kilobyte chunks, which only take a couple minutes to get over a modem at home, and we send them out to people all around the world in 100 different countries.
So if people want to help you, what do they have to do?
If you're interested in the SETI at Home project and you'd like to participate, you can download the screensaver. It's a free program. The URL that you have to go to on the Internet is seti.ssl.berkeley.edu. I'll give it again. It's SETI, S-E-T-I, .ssl, like Space Science Labs, .berkeley, That's BERKELEY .edu, like education.
Okay, I've downloaded the screensaver plus that data. How is it different from an ordinary screensaver then? What does it do?
Instead of displaying flying toasters on your screen or swimming goldfish, it's actually searching for strong radio signals from a distant civilization. The idea here is that another civilization may be sending out something like our television or a radar signal or perhaps a navigational beacon. Earth has been sending out television for about 50 years. I Love Lucy, Ed Sullivan Show have now gone past several thousand stars. We may be able to find some artifact of a civilization, or if we're very lucky, maybe they're sending us an intentional signal that would contain their Library of Congress, all their music, their poetry, literature, science, medicine. That would be really exciting. Maybe we'll get the URL to the galactic internet.
But as well as searching different parts of the skies, then, the radio telescope presumably has to check all the possible frequencies. Is it looking at any specific part of the dial?
We're looking at a place called the microwave window, which is the best place for interstellar communication. Right now, we don't have enough computing power to look at all the different frequencies that another civilization might use. So we're just looking at a small band that we think is the best for interstellar communication. The SETI at Home is a 2-year program. If it's successful, then we will expand the search and look at more channels, more of the band. It's like tuning your radio dial and looking at this signal strength meter, and if the signal strength meter goes up, that's what gets our attention. That's what the screensaver is looking for. It's going through billions of different frequencies, looking for a lot of different signal types, and if it finds any interesting signal, it records it on your hard disk, and then after it's finished analyzing the whole data work unit, it says, hey, can I send the results back to Berkeley over the internet and get a new piece of data to analyze?
Do you see anything yourself? I mean, are you, as a user, do you get to see the Eureka, or is it up to you to actually put all these jigsaws together?
You don't have to watch your screen. It's automatically analyzing the data, but you can watch the screen, and it shows how the strongest signal it's found so far, what part of the sky you're analyzing right now. It tells you if there's any strong signals, but it finds strong signals occasionally that are not due to extraterrestrials. We have test signals, we have satellites and planes that fly over the telescope. There's a lot of radio pollution. We have to go sort through that. So when you find a strong signal, I wouldn't call the press right away. You have to wait for us to sort through it, find out if it was really an interesting signal or if it turned out to be interference from some terrestrial activity.
You've been running a couple of days now. What sort of response have you had?
It's been overwhelming. You know, already we've got 150,000 people analyzing data for us, and we've already got the world's largest supercomputer. It's very exciting for us, and we're very pleased that the public has given us overwhelming support. I think a lot of people are interested in this question. Are we alone? Is anybody out there? I'm optimistic. I think the universe is likely to be teeming with life.
More intelligent than life on Earth?
The Sun is a middle-aged star. Our star is 5 billion years old, but some stars are 10 billion years old. So you can imagine very advanced civilizations might be out there. Perhaps they're all talking to each other. We're just getting in the game. Earthlings have only had radio 100 years. That's a blink of an eye in our history.
Itself keeps on expanding and expanding in all of the directions it can whiz. As fast as it can go, at the speed of light, you know, 12 million miles a minute, and that's the fastest speed there is. So remember when you're feeling very small and insecure, how amazingly unlikely is your birth. And pray that there's intelligent life somewhere up in space, 'cause there's bugger all down here on Earth.
More in 7 days. In the meantime, don't forget to check our website.
And do have a pleasant Whitsun weekend.
Media Network is a Radio Netherlands presentation. Copyright 1999. All rights reserved.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.